From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. The program is produced by Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Jason Croft. On the program today, Computers in You. Peter Kimball is with us this morning. He's with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Listeners, I welcome your questions about computers for Peter Kimball. Join us with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Peter, welcome back. Good to see you.
It's good to be back, and happy Groundhog Day.
And the same to you as well. And happy New Year, because I haven't seen you since December,
That's right.
It's been a while.
Both the traditional New Year and also the Lunar New Year since we've last been together. Mm-hmm. So that's three holidays we're behind.
Okay. Well, one of the things you suggested we talk about this morning, if we didn't have calls right away, was a little bit of looking into the future. And this, you suggested we talk about IBM's 5 for 5. What is it?
Well, for the last 6 or 7 years or so, IBM has been making predictions about kinds of technologies that may come to pass or may be more fully developed within the next 5 years. So in 2007, of course, their predictions were for the things that we might well see in 2012. These are not entirely isolated from the kinds of things IBM is working on, but they're still fairly interesting. They give them pretty flashy titles. But I'll give you a couple of examples. One of them that they just announced in December of last year, so these are the predictions from 2011 for 2016 or so,
okay,
is with regard to energy, people power, so that a lot of the little devices that we have and, of course, to some extent much larger energy needs, your shoes as you're walking. There's a lot of energy as the soles flex, as your heel hit the ground. That could be harnessed fairly easily with existing technology. So you may never have a cell phone that gets out of charge again. It's on a small scale, very much like ocean tidal energy that you might bring in. In terms of security, you may never, ever need a password again. A lot of people use the same password for lots of mm-hmm. sites, which is not good. It's not good because people are going to necessarily crack one individual's own logon, but with so many reports of banks and others and merchants being hacked directly and access being gained to all their customer records, if, as could happen, that got access to some passwords and somebody could get a hold of a password. If that's the same password you use on all your other sites, that could be a problem. Anyway, the IBM prediction is that those will gradually fade away in favor of biometrics, things like fast retinal recognition, fingerprints, combinations of two or three of those sorts of things, so that you could even store it, for example, on a cell phone, and if somebody else stole your cell phone, it would do them no good because they don't have the matching retinal, the matching fingerprints and various other technologies. So that's the second of their various predictions.
Why don't we come back to those as time allows?
All right.
And take a call.
And we'll also take a look at how they did
exactly.
In 2007 with the predictions for 2012. Yes.
Okay. Well, let's take a call. This is a listener in Champaign on line 4. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question about startup protection, and I'm wondering if I am slightly overprotected on my computer. I've got a AT&T UVerse, the hardware firewall, and then for software, I've got Windows firewall turned on. The Avira Free starts at startup. I have Spybot Search and Destroy, and finally, Malwarebytes. So is that is any of that duplicative to the point to where I need to shut some of that off?
Well, I'm assuming that only one of those programs, the Windows You've got the Windows firewall. You've got SpyBot, which is really not an antivirus program. It's just looking for spyware. I think it probably is a bit redundant. Absolutely, you want to have only one antivirus program installed on your machine at a time, because if there's more than one, they will get in each other's way, slow down performance significantly, and so that's the most common error. You definitely want antivirus, and there's, if you're using, since you were using Windows, if you're using Windows 7 or 8, even Windows Security Essentials is quite good. The fact that you have some protection from, on the physical side, from AT&T's UVerse system, I'm not that familiar with its capabilities and how its performance is, but probably pretty good. So I would say that you could probably get rid of some of those. In fact, the SpyBot and the malicious software, you know, remove your software, are more the sorts of things that if I were going to use them, because little of that gets through now, it gets caught by your antivirus and such because they've expanded, and I would probably not have those running. I would perhaps run them once in a while manually, but not have them all sitting there chewing up resources and looking at everything that comes through your system.
Okay, so you're saying SpyBot I should probably get rid of, and Malwarebytes just use an occasionally scan?
That sounds reasonable to me, yes. Assuming you've got, what was your antivirus program again?
It's Avira.
I can't tell you very much about that without looking it up, but that should be, if it's reputable, I've heard the name, it should be fine. You might want to, because it's always worth taking a look at this periodically, do a quick search for antivirus reviews and look at those at places like CNET and PC Magazine and such, those that don't have a particular commercial axe to grind, and see how yours is ranked, not only in terms of protection, but in terms of its use of system resources.
Okay, yeah, and it does also say if I go to the Action Center and the control panel, and I am running Windows 7, is under the spyware and unwanted software protection section. It says Windows Defender and Anti-Vir Desktop both report that they are turned on. Note: running two or more anti-spyware programs at the same time can cause your computer to run slowly.
Exactly. So, yes, I think the simple answer to your initial question is, yes, you're a little overprotected.
Okay, so, yeah. As far as the firewall, though, I'm sorry, I'm going to have one last question here.
Sure.
For the firewall itself, should I disable either Windows Defender or the firewall in the antivirus suite?
Yes, I wouldn't. You wouldn't want both of them.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Thanks for the call this morning. Other calls are welcome, as are email messages. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We're talking about computers today with Peter Kimball of the University of Illinois. He's with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the U of I at Urbana-Champaign. So take us back to the last round of IBM's 5 for 5, and how did they do in terms of where we are today?
They did pretty well, depending upon how you define some of these things, and keeping in mind that when they do the 5 and 5, basically press release, they jazz up the titles a little bit to make them look pretty exciting. One of them that is certainly advanced tremendously is what back in 2007, they said real-time speech translation, once a vision only in science fiction, will become the norm. That's where your device, could be a cell phone, could be a computer, can in real time translate from one language to another, sort of like the universal translator that you see on certain science fiction programs. That has been less than exciting for a lot of English speakers. In fact, I've seen some people commenting on this, well, you know, I travel all over, and I generally can find somebody who speaks English, so it's not a big problem. But a native Russian speaker living in Moscow said, if I go 600 miles to the north, 600 miles to the east or to the south, I need to know a different language frequently. So it has gotten much more powerful. Computers have become able to do that much more accurately. Is it ready for prime time yet? No, but there's significant advances. So if we say 5 stars completely realized, maybe 3.5 or 4 mm-hmm. stars, so it's definitely headed there.
Okay.
Another one that I can do fairly quickly, and again, it's a kind of a so what question for some, the 3D internet will become a reality. Again, this is a 2007 prediction for 2012. And that, again, depending on how you want to define it, has actually come to pass. I know a number of people, they're primarily gamers, but some of them are actually watching 3D movies on their computer systems and with the appropriate glasses and the whole business. There are some very impressive major games available that, if you have the processing power in your computer to handle it, it's almost equivalent to what you would see in a well-done 3D theatrical presentation.
Interesting.
So that would have to probably get four stars. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to be browsing, you know, Amazon.com in 3D anytime soon, but, you know, heaven help us.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you this. You know, in terms of apps, applications that you can get for your computer, your phone, whatever, your tablet, there are some that say they are HD, and they have like, for example, Angry Birds. There's a Angry Birds, and then there's Angry Birds HD. Is there any difference?
Well, the difference is going to whether you will see a difference depends upon the device that you're looking at it.
Okay.
HD in its more pure definition, so to speak, means high definition. It's not the same thing that HD radio means at all. And basically, HD refers to having more picture information so that you have more detail, more clarity. It's exactly analogous. In fact, it is not even analogous. It is the same thing as the difference between a standard old television image and a HD image on a television set that can produce it. Now, if you are playing something like, you know, Angry Birds on your cell phone, there's not a great deal of advantage to HD, except that the initial releases of some of these programs were actually fairly low resolution, meaning that it would play fairly well on pretty skimpy screens that didn't have a lot of detail available to them. And the HD so-called versions of those, they're not going to be like the HD that you would see on a widescreen cinema or on a television set, but on a cell phone that can handle it. And a lot of the iPhones and a lot of the Android phones and others actually have screens that are one quarter of the pixels of regular HD computer screens. It's really gotten remarkable. So there is a definite difference, okay. And it is noticeable if you've got the hardware. Of course, that's part of the vicious circle. Gee, I'd like to see this in HD. I guess I got to buy a new machine, buy a new cell phone.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Mattoon, line one. Hi.
Good morning. I have a Dell Dimension 2200 desktop, and I have a number of peripherals hooked up to it. And recently I bought new USB hubs in order to connect everything. And I'm wondering if I can just turn off my computer and connect all my peripherals and then turn everything back on, or if I have to do them one at a time until I have the entire system redone. The USB hubs do say that they're hot swappable, so that, you know, you don't have to turn the computer off to install each individual item.
The items you're installing connected what, external devices like printers and...
Yeah, I've got a couple of printers. I've got an external combination card reader and CD burner, you know, everything from a Sidewinder game controller to my sound system to a turntable that lets me, you know, record albums into digital form. So I put them on an MP3 player, et cetera, scanner.
Well, you're correct. The USB generally is hot swappable. You can plug things in. You need to be careful unplugging them if it's something that is actually writing to a disk, if it's an external disk drive or something, or a thumb drive. But I don't think you really need to undo everything, turn it off, undo everything, put it back in. In fact, what I would tend to do once you have the new USB plugged into the USB port in your Dimension, is just plug in one of the devices and make sure it's working okay, because each time you plug one in, it may well need to download appropriate or to activate to bring in appropriate drivers for that USB device. And
okay. So even if the computer's on and I use the hot swap feature, I should still reconnect just one at a time.
I would do that just because you want to make sure that if something doesn't work, gee, which of these 12 things I just plugged in is giving me a problem? Do it one, make sure it works, plug in the next, see if that works.
All righty.
And once you've done it, then you're all set. Then you don't have to worry about the having to do anything one at a time in the future.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
You're quite welcome.
And next we talk with a listener in Bloomington on line 4. Hello.
Yes, hello. Yeah, I got one problem. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay. I bought this HP printer, all-in-one, 8600 model, and it's wirelessly connected to all computers at home, whether desktop or laptop. Now, you can print from any one of the computers. But you cannot scan on some of the computers, okay? Now, you can scan out of all those computers that are equipped with XP operating system. And you can scan out of one laptop which is furnished with Vista. And you cannot scan from a computer that is furnished with Windows 7 and another one laptop, which is furnished with Vista. And I tried about everything in line or anywhere. I couldn't solve the problem. Can you help me with that?
Well, it sounds very much like the problem with the Windows 7 machine, at least, is having the appropriate driver, the software that handles the communications between the computer and the actual scanner.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things to initially try is, especially with a laptop that is not working, is have you tried connecting these directly to the scanner and not trying to go over your home network with them?
I connected it with wire and I tried. It didn't work. There is no communication between the scanner and the computers of Windows 7 and Vista.
Okay, and that is when they are physically connected with I presume it's a USB cable.
Yeah. It's not going to be, whether wirelessly or even if you connect them with USB.
Okay, so that tells us that probably since it is simpler to get things to work, and there are less areas of problems if it is wirelessly, if we are able to get it to work, or if you are able to get it to work while wired up, it will probably also then work wirelessly. So, and working on them while they are connected will simply eliminate one potential area that you'll have to deal with. Again, the situation is almost certainly with the driver software. With those two particular machines, the machine that's running Windows 7, and the other machine that's running Vista, are they newer machines? Are they older machines?
No, the Windows 7 is a new machine, but the Vista is about 4 years old.
Well, if the machine that's running Windows 7 is newer, then it probably is not a problem internal to the machine in what's called its basic operating system, its BIOS, so to speak. That's an acronym, BIOS. That could be a problem with the other. I would I presume you have visited the HP site and download and with those particular machines and downloaded updated drivers.
I did all that.
Okay. I'm trying to think of what else I could advise to do with those.
I disabled I tried by disabling all the firewalls to just try to make it work. Still, it don't.
Well, I'm still suspicious. Whenever I've seen that sort of problem before, and it's not a physical connection problem, I am still always suspicious of the driver software. I guess what I would try to do, and I presume that you have done this as well, and I'm not sure that we can go into it in a whole lot of detail in the time we have, but when you search for on Google or elsewhere for cannot scan with Win 7 HP Premier all in one, there are almost certainly going to be others who have that problem. Have you looked at through some of those and seen what, if any, solutions work for others who have had this difficulty?
Okay, I didn't get in that, but I'll try to look in that.
That's when all else fails, when it's not something obvious, that's generally going to be the next most successful thing. You've done the obvious things that would be the initial advice. Make sure you've got the updated drivers. Make sure that you're doing it while connected via a wire so that it's not a wireless issue. And then do a search. You may have to fiddle around with the search terms a little bit, but include the HP Premier All-in-One, or even the model number would be fine, probably. Scan doesn't work. Include the, not so much the Windows 7 or the Vista, but the actual model of the machine, but you could include Windows 7 there. And I would guess within 10 or 15 minutes of searching, you would probably find a site where people have had this or a very closely related problem, and you can see what sorts of solutions, hopefully, they have found for that.
Okay. All right.
So you're not reinventing the wheel. Look out there and see who else has had this problem. And the web is, and so many people are actively reporting these sorts of things, that it's a tremendous resource.
Okay. Could you tell me a specific web that I could get in?
I would simply use a search engine such as Google, and then simply enter those search terms of HP Premier or the model number. Can't scan would be a phrase to include. The name of the computer you've got. You may occasionally have to add or delete keywords, but you're just doing it from Google and then seeing what sites it has. You'll get a whole list, a huge list, probably hundreds of pages, but the first several pages, some of them won't do you much good and some of them may, but I suspect that that's how you'll find that you're not alone with this, that other people have dealt with it and hopefully been able to solve it without too much difficulty.
All right, okay.
And good luck to you.
Okay, thanks.
Good luck with that problem. This is Focus, and you wanted to say something else?
Oh, Peter? I was just going to say there comes a point at which all the standard sorts of acts that one is advised to do don't work, and then you go out there and look and see what have other people done.
Yeah, and chances are somebody's had the same problem.
I've done that several times. I've been dealing with computers for many, many years. I don't even know how many. Need a computer to count it up, I suppose. and I'm still doing that.
So this morning here on Focus, we're talking about computers with Peter Kimball. He is our guest today. He is with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. Listeners, I welcome your questions about computers for Peter. Join us with a phone call or by email. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. And the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. My name is Celeste Quinn, and we'd love to hear from you this morning. If you've got, if you need some troubleshooting advice, if you're interested in new trends in technology or safe computing, we're happy to take your call. Look at your email and put those questions to Peter Kimball. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and will-talk@illinois.edu. Google is making some changes regarding its privacy policy, correct?
And it certainly is.
So can you bring us up to date on that?
Yes, and in fact, that's going to, if we have, depending on how many calls we get, that's going to segue into one of IBM's predictions, five on five.
Okay.
Basically, Google has lots of different services, as most people know. There's the ubiquitous search engine, there's YouTube, there's the Gmail, there's Google Docs. I had read someplace that there are about 70 such services that Google offers. And what they are doing for 60 of those services, they say, is they're simplifying and wrapping up all of their slightly different privacy policies into one overriding privacy policy that will go into effect on the 1st of March of this year. It's much simpler, but it also says that some of these, because it's sort of all one big happy family now, some information can be shared between these services. To some extent, you'll be able to opt out of that. But one example that Google gives is, for example, if you are using YouTube and you're looking up golf courses and such, you may find that when you're doing Google searches that you get a preponderance of golf-related ads because that information is being shared between those Google services. Now, I've always been somewhat loath to share more information than I wish, than I have to, actually. I don't wish to share that much. Where most of that information is going to come and be correlated is if somebody actually is logged on to Google, which you can do. You can simply log on to your Google account, and then you can do searches. You can use the Google toolbar. You can go to YouTube. You can do your Gmail. You can do this. You can do that, do the other. And if you're doing it while you're all logged in, that's all connected. It knows it's you. And there is an astounding amount of information that can be collected from your search queries because it keeps track of that. Now, not, as they say, in a personally identifiable way that they'll be able to come back and tell anybody other than law enforcement if they're asked. But it builds up a pretty good picture. At the same time that Google has been saying this is really going to be simple, it's important, you should read it, Google is also promoting to its advertisers that this is going to be a tremendous opportunity to target individual users with things they're interested in. So what does one do? Well, one can, of course, not be logged into Google when you're doing a lot of this. One cannot opt out of this policy. And the IBM 5 and 5 prediction that relates to this is in 5 years the end of junk mail as we know it. That doesn't mean there won't be spam mail out there, but what IBM is saying is ties really closely into this Google privacy policy. Two factors involved. One is that the true spam filters, you know, pharmaceuticals and other kinds of things, the filters will get so good that that will become less effective and you'll hardly ever see it. And the other aspect is that advertising, what we would probably call spam mail, will be so closely targeted to your interests, such as great deals on golf courses or great deals on greens fees or something, if we go back to that golf analogy, that people will want to read it because it will be right up their alley of interest. And that's because they've collected all of the information.
Yeah.
And they can start targeting this so directly that you'll say, oh, you know, great, this looks interesting.
Yeah. Well, we're there a little bit already because sites will ask you or say to you, we have these recommendations for you. So they have been, you know, they know something about us.
Amazon has done an incredible job with that. They are probably one of the leaders in the field in terms of not only other people who bought this book have also liked this one, for example, or even more generically. And that's the where things are going.
Yeah. Well, this is Focus, and we're talking about computers today with Peter Kimball of the University of Illinois. And we're going to take some more calls in just a moment. But first, a short break.
Fading on a curve.
On the next Fresh Air, the producers of Smash, the new NBC backstage musical drama about the people putting together a Broadway musical. We'll hear from Neil Marin and Craig Zaden. Join us.
The past fades away because as of this day,
this afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
This is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Quick note here about tomorrow at 11. Focus at 11 tomorrow. We'll talk about dogs. I'll be back in the host's chair. Our guest tomorrow will be Jim Keel and Robin Haggard. We'll talk about dogs, dog training, care, and behavior. That's Focus at 11 tomorrow. Let's go back to the phones now. First, we take a call from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello. I've got a question about, well, it results from buying a new computer. I have a laptop which has a comparatively small hard drive, and really I don't want to put crucial information on it anyway, tax returns and banking information. I've got a 2 terabyte hard drive in a USB 3 enclosure. It will attach directly to the new computer, but I was thinking about attaching it to the network. I think I'd need a device that plugs into the network and then gives USB output. Would there be much difference in access speed?
There would be a difference in access speed. The most noticeable difference would be if you were connecting wirelessly, because most domestic wireless networks where you've got your access point are not going to be as fast as a wired connection. But that really shouldn't matter a lot for the size of typical word processing documents. It shouldn't matter much for, you know, tax records and such. Those are all such small files that you would never notice the difference.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to bring down, if you had stored on that, you know, a high-definition movie stored on that external drive, you might not get that down as quickly. I mean, you would notice a definite difference in speed, no question about that. And especially since your connection is a USB 3. USB 3 is very fast, so it's the connection, overall connection from your storage device to the computer is going to be no faster than the slowest link. Those slowest links in order would be a wireless connection, and even the wired connection is going to perhaps be not much faster than USB 3, but you shouldn't really notice it if it is wired. You will notice it for very large files if you're connecting wirelessly.
I do get 18 gigabyte files from my camera, but what I was thinking was probably the main disadvantage of connecting the hard drive to the new notebook would be that I have to have both computers turned on in order to use the network to reach the hard drive.
Yes. And that is true, and that would be one example. That would be one excellent example of having the network storage device. Now, that is still a device that you'll have to have on, but it's not a computer, of course.
Right.
And so that would be a definite advantage. And if you were doing that, that's the sort of thing I would do. Now, a lot of the newer one of the options for the network attached storage, it's called, the acronym is NAS. A lot of those devices have that software built into them, and you can just plug them into your router.
Mm-hmm.
Others may not have, in which case you may need to plug it into some sort of controller that plugs into it. I've not actually researched those. Do have network associated storage, network attached storage in place in a couple of different areas, and it works very well. So I don't know if that answers your question or not. Yes, it would be an advantage. You might actually check if your particular 2-terabyte external drive was one of the models that did not support NAS. There is almost certainly a small NAS controller that you could attach that would simply go between your router and the device. In fact, I know there are. I just can't tell you any names. I've actually seen some of them.
It sounded from talking to the salesperson at Computer Deli as though it would need the, what is it, NSF or anyway, that device.
Yes, the network attached storage device, yes.
So
that would be an external device. It wouldn't be very expensive. It has no storage of itself. It's just acting as the receiver and distributor of requests that come from the network to your attached hard drive.
Would there be any possibility that my printer could be plugged into that? It is using using USB 2, and so it wouldn't get any higher speed.
Well, and you don't need higher speed with a printer.
No.
There is certainly a possibility. You would have to make sure that the device, the NAS device you did, was also, and I suspect there are some of these out there, could also act as what is called a print server. Again, that's built into a lot of newer network-enabled printers, but the print server is basically doing for printing what your NAS controller, network attached storage controller, would do for the hard drive. It receives the requests. It queues them up appropriately so that if, you know, people from two different machines make requests to print at the same time, you don't get problems, and sends it out to the printer via the wired connection. You would, of course, have to have your device that is now serving as both a NAS and a print server physically close to both the hard drive and the printer, so you could connect them wired.
They'd be within 4 or 5 feet.
Yeah, that's not a problem. And if you can't find, or if it turns out to be a little expensive, finding a single device that does both the network attached storage and also the print server, and if you've got one or two extra connections on your router,
I have.
Then you could actually, there are standalone for, I don't know, $50 maybe even less than that, print server boxes that would plug into an Ethernet port on one side and plug into your USB. I presume it's a USB printer in the other. Yeah, you said it was USB 2.
The printer is a USB 2.
Yeah.
The new computer has a USB 3 and the hard drive is USB 3.
Yeah, and there are no issues with interconnecting those. When you connect a USB 2 device to a USB 3 capable device, it just runs at the USB 2 speeds.
Mm-hmm. Well, that seems pretty well answered. It would be best to have the hard drive separate, not attached to one of the computers, and then get the NS, whatever it is.
NAS.
Yes,
that would most likely be the best solution. That way you also don't have to worry about setting up the appropriate sharing on the computer to which the hard drive is attached, because it's all being handled by that network attached storage device.
Yeah, and then you don't have to worry about both computers being on. If you want to print something when you're sitting in the living room with the notebook using Wi-Fi, you don't have to check the other computer is on with a printer attached to it and that sort of thing.
Right. And I'll throw out just one other quick suggestion. With your cable or whatever sort of modem you've got and your router and your NAS storage and the hard drive, a fairly inexpensive, uninterruptible power supply, because it's not driving much power, plug those into it in the middle of a power outage. Since you've got the laptop, you'll still have your storage. You'll still have your Internet connection.
I think so, I may need a larger one. I've got one that's fairly good size that my old computer's attached to, but
this could be just a small one that only has those devices.
Oh, and just have just a little one, and it would just be those devices.
Yeah, because they don't draw much power.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Okay. Good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, and we've got an email query next, and then we're going to take some more calls. The email says, "My email addresses were hacked last Friday. Evidently, my Yahoo address was hit first and then my Comcast account. I did some research and saw that my Yahoo account was accessed from Turkey and Brazil from a mobile device. I assume that they picked up my Comcast account from there since it is a secondary on the Yahoo account. They do have different passwords. I've changed both passwords to different, stronger passwords. I changed options on Yahoo so that it cannot be accessed from a mobile device. I wrote notes to everyone in both address books to warn them. I cleaned out my address book so that this would be easier in the future. Is there anything else I can do? I am concerned about the Comcast account. That address book was only available on my computer, not online. Would the hackers have accessed my entire computer? I have tax forms and the like on it, so that's a concern.
Probably not a concern with regard to the other information on the computer. If the email accounts have been hacked, and that's unfortunately fairly common, and it's good that the writer has made more robust passwords, then that is not really going to cause an issue, assuming that, as one hopes nobody does, that she doesn't, or he or she does not have in stored email on her Yahoo account, email that she sent to her accountant with all of her tax information in it. But anything that's not in her email account or that's not in the email account on Comcast, there's several other steps that would have had to have been taken to compromise her computer system. There's really, from what she says or he says, I don't know why I keep assuming it's whoever it is.
it's mostly a she. Because, it makes it easier.
Yeah, well, yeah. The last person I dealt with was, and I've talked about this, was also a she. But it sounds like she took all the appropriate steps. The one thing she won't really be able to do or control, but she's taken defensive steps. It's possible that some of her contacts may be getting mail that look like they're coming from her accounts. They won't be because she's changed the accounts, but it's easy enough to spoof email addresses. So it may look like it's coming from MarySmith@Yahoo.com. Oh, I was traveling in Europe and you know there was a misunderstanding and I'm arrested. Can you just wire me $2,000 and I'll pay it back when I get back? That's a fairly common kind of scam. Those sorts of things probably won't happen, but there's nothing she can really do to prevent it once they know what an email address is. They don't have to have access to make it look like it's coming. I could be sending messages that would look for all the world unless somebody looked into it that they were coming from you, for example, Celeste.
Okay. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Kankakee waiting for us on line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I have a laptop in my office. And I just recently I've been getting a pop-up from Norton that says my virus control or my virus help on my computer is about to run out. And because I've just recently bought a computer, that's why they're sending me this note. Is that should I be suspect of that or because I haven't recently bought a computer? I bought it in 2007. That's not recent in my history.
Well, first question I would ask, maybe suspicious, but is your current antivirus program Norton?
It was, yeah.
Well, it could well be, since you are on the Norton mailing list because you had Norton antivirus products at one point, and if they see that it's been outdated, I will occasionally get email, but generally not pop-ups, but I will occasionally get email from antivirus companies with whom I'd had a prior association saying, you know, you may be out of date. If you're not using Norton now, I would check to make sure that there is no leftover Norton software installed. You can try that from the control panel. Okay. You can also, with that pop-up, now that pop-up appears basically when you're visiting websites. And
every time I turn the machine on.
So it is something then in the startup. And what does it actually ask you to do? Click here to click on a link?
Click here, and I'm sure they have a cost, and I'm sure they want a credit card. And
oh, sure.
I'm uncomfortable with doing that unless I know that that's a reality and there's no telephone number that I can call.
Well, how to determine if it's happening when you first start up? One of the things I would do would be to, with whatever your antivirus software that you're currently using, I would run a full deep scan on your computer to make sure that this is not something that is malicious software. Not using Norton, of course, because that's not what you have installed. Mm-hmm. And then if it passes that test, if it doesn't say, oh, we've got this, the other thing, now, will this message stay up if until you dismiss it, or does it go away?
Yeah, I have to say, remind me tomorrow or something, and then I can exit out of it.
What you could do, and you could load up other programs while you're just leaving that annoying thing there, I presume.
Yeah, but I don't want to do that.
Yeah, I know you wouldn't want to do that. What I'm suggesting is once you've got that up, you can launch the task manager. You're using Windows, I assume.
Yes.
You can launch the task manager once you're logged on by pressing, as you may know, Control, Alt, and Delete simultaneously. The screen will kind of blank out, and you'll see a series of things. Do you want to log out? Do you want to change your password,
right,
et cetera?
Right, right.
One of them is Task Manager, and it will list the various programs that are running. And there's also a tab in there. If you see the actual program, and it should be there, you can click on it or perhaps right-click on it and say, go to Process. That's the underlying software that's doing it. That will give you the name of the process. Then you can do a search on Google, just typing the name of that process in,
right. And
see what it says. Now, be aware that when you type the name of a process in, some websites will say, this is how you could remove that process. They're just interested in selling you, you know, some kind of registry.
Yeah, stuff. Right.
But that would certainly give you more information. And if you find one of those sites that says, yes, this is a typical thing from Norton, then you could do a search saying Google search saying remove Norton reminder notice and find out what it is that you actually have to do to prevent that thing from happening.
Okay. All right. Great. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And next we go to Sycamore, line two. Hi.
Yeah. Good morning. I'm curious to hear your comments about two things. One is solid state memory. And then also, could you comment on the health of Moore's Law, indicating that speeds are going to double every so often? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, we're going to hang up and listen.
All right. Well, okay. Solid-state memory. I'm in favor of it. Basically, solid-state memory is using electronic memory, like the RAM that people have, in larger amounts instead of having a spinning disk drive. So that you have no mechanical parts to fail, so that you have access times 10 to 100 times faster. The cost is still higher compared to a standard spinning hard drive, but that cost is gradually coming down, and a lot of the really thin notebooks now will have maybe the equivalent of a hard drive that's maybe 128 gigabytes or 200 gigabytes of solid-state storage. And they are fast, they are light, they don't draw as much power, and they're still more expensive. Moore's Law, somewhat famously, back in the, I think probably the 1980s, might have even been a little bit earlier than that, the amount of transistors, the amount of computing power, if you will, that are on a, that can be manufactured on a chip, on an integrated circuit chip, is going to double every, well, depending on who you ask, every 18 months or every couple of years or so. And that has been true pretty much up until now. And it seemed at two or three times in the past that eventually that has to stop. There can't be, there has to be some kind of asymptotic limit there at the end. But it doesn't seem now to be coming any time within the next few years. I think Moore's Law is still going to be good with some of the newer technologies that are coming out. They're now able to have much finer, much smaller chips that have switches that are only a few atoms thick that they're being able to develop. And that's going to make, I think, Moore's Law, it might slow down a little bit from every 18 months to 2 years, but I think it's still going to be in effect for the next 5 years, let's say.
Okay.
You can go back to five and five.
Okay, very good. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up here. We've got one call. I'm sorry we can't take. We're going to do another show on computers coming up March 1st, I believe. It's the first Thursday of the month, right, when we do this program? Yes, and Jim Irek and Debbie Flieger should be with us in March. So save your question for next time around. Peter, good to see you, as always.
Good to see you. I'll see you
in April.
Okay. But probably not on April Fool's Day. I don't think it comes out on the first that day.
Okay, all right. So very good. Peter Kimball has been our guest in this portion of the program. He is with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.